You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 25 in a series of the books of 1st and 2nd Kings. 2nd Kings, chapter 16. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. At that time Rezin, the king of Syria, recovered Elath for Syria, and drove the men of Judah from Elath, and the Edomites came to Elath, where they dwell to this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house, and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. When King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, he saw the altar that was at Damascus, and King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. And Uriah the priest built the altar in accordance with all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus. And when the king came from Damascus, the king viewed the altar. Then the king drew near to the altar and went up on it, and burned his burnt offering and his grain offering, and poured his drink offering, and threw the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. And the bronze altar that was before the Lord he removed from the front of the house, from the place between his altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of his altar. And King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, On the great altar burn the morning burnt offering, and the evening grain offering, and the king's burnt offering, and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, and their grain offering, and their drink offering, and throw on it all the blood of the burnt offering, and all the blood of the sacrifice, but the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. Uriah the priest did all this as King Ahaz commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands, and removed the basin from them, and he took down the sea from the bronze oxen that were under it, and put it on a stone pedestal. And the covered way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house, and the outer entrance for the king, he caused to go round the house of the Lord, because of the king of Assyria. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaz, that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Hezekiah his son reigned in his place. We'll pause our reading there after verse 60 at the end of 2 Kings 16. Now, it's important to say something in this chapter about the intrigues that were going on between the nations surrounding Judah. We're dealing with the king of Judah, Ahaz, here, reigning in Jerusalem from the royal family, descended from David. But we see his interaction with the northern kingdom and with Syria. And, of course, these two powers are working together to the north of Judah to fight against Judah. But they are in alliance against Assyria, and had hoped that Judah would join them in that alliance, because the rising power at this time is the Assyrians. And you may be familiar that the northern kingdom is going to become be defeated and destroyed by the Assyrians in 722 BC. We're rapidly approaching that date. Tiglath-Pileser III, who we read about in this passage, reigned from 745 to 727 BC. Assyria became the dominant power in the region, and was so until around 626 BC, when really their power began to wane because the Babylonians or Chaldeans, the Neo-Babylonians, started to gain in power. In 612 BC, the Babylonians took the city of Nineveh, which had been the capital of Assyria. And finally, in 605 BC, at Carchemish, there was a battle, the final battle, when Babylon conclusively defeated Assyria. And so these kings, Rezin of Aram or of Syria, Aram and Syria, of course, being the same place, and Pekah, the king of Israel, have allied together and want Judah. They're trying to force Judah through force of arms to join them. They invade Jerusalem, or Judah rather, and besiege Jerusalem, but they are unable to conquer him. And as a response, Ahaz sends to the king of Assyria to come and help him. And the king of Assyria comes and takes Damascus and carries its people captive, and he kills Rezin. And so this is a decisive shift in power, that Aram or Syria is now under the authority of Assyria. And that has opened the way for Assyria to come further down and attack the northern kingdom of Israel. So that's one thing that's going on here. We have a king of Judah allying himself with the Assyrians, who are a most wicked people. It doesn't seem right, does it? And he contributes, of course, to their growth in power. But God is working out his purpose through this. The Assyrians will be the cause of the exile of the northern kingdom and its destruction, but not of the southern kingdom. It's not until the Babylonians in around 586 BC that the southern kingdom will finally be destroyed. The second significant feature from Ahaz's reign concerns this altar. He sees an altar in Damascus when he goes to meet the conquering Assyrian king, and he is intrigued by this altar and sends details about it to Uriah the priest and asks that an altar like it be built for him in Jerusalem. And he remodels the temple to put his altar, his bronze altar, in a special place. He brings his sacrifices to it. It's to be the king's altar, distinct from the altar that's used for the other sacrifices. He also takes off the stands of the sea, the great basin where there was for ritual cleansing and symbolic of God's sovereignty over the earth, I think. And he takes that down from the bronze oxen and puts it on a stone pedestal, and he redirects the covered way that had been built inside the temple. Or rather, sorry, I've explained that wrongly. It's the opposite way around. The bronze altar that the king uses is the original altar. And this new altar, which seems to be bigger and grander, will be used for the other sacrifices for the people. Now, what is Ahaz doing in making these changes? Well, it's difficult to know what exactly we're to make of what Ahaz does here. It's possible to suggest that he is wanting God to have as grand an altar as the one that exists in Damascus, which is either an Assyrian altar or an altar that was used by the kings of Syria. So it could be that. But remember the beginning of this chapter, its analysis of Ahaz is negative. He did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He even burned his son as an offering. He's involved in sacrifices in high places. He's not a devout worshipper of God. And so it seems unlikely that this was an act of loyalty to God, not impossible. But the way the passage describes it as well might give us some clues. The fact that he got the idea from Damascus, the fact that he has made himself effectively a vassal, an under-king, under the king of Assyria. He goes to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, and at the end of the passage in verse 18, it says that the redirection of the covered walkway is because of the king of Assyria, or in deference to the king of Assyria. Some people have suggested maybe this altar was to worship the gods of Assyria, a requirement of the king of Assyria, but that seems unlikely. We don't know of any such requirement from the pages of history, that Assyrian kings forced their vassals to rule to worship their own gods. Perhaps it's something to do with his exalted view of himself as king. It's been pointed out by some commentators that throughout the passage from verse 10 onwards, he's called King Ahaz repeatedly. Before this, he's simply called Ahaz at the beginning of the chapter. If you notice that, verses 1 and 2, even in verse 7, Ahaz sent. But when you get to verse 10, it's King Ahaz twice, and again in verse 11, twice, and then the king in verse 12, and twice. It's all about his actions as the king. And so it perhaps has something to do with his idea that the bronze altar, small though it is, has the legacy, and that will be used alone for him. This other altar is good enough for the other sacrifices. Very difficult to know, but the writer clearly sees this as significant. I think perhaps the most significant thing of all is that here is a king who remodels the temple, yes, but who doesn't inquire of God, who does not serve God. Even if this is an act of homage to Yahweh, to the God of Israel, he's not an exclusive worshipper of God. He is a bad king. And this is the man who was king at the time of King of Isaiah the prophet. In Isaiah 7, it talks about the sign of Emmanuel, God with us, which of course has its ultimate fulfillment in the Lord Jesus. But Ahaz didn't want the sign from Isaiah. Ahaz is the king who needs to be replaced by a new born king who will be God with us, Emmanuel. Ahaz is not a faithful king. So let's read on into 2 Kings chapter 17. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel, and he reigned for 9 years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, yet not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and put him in prison. Then the king of Assyria invaded all the land and came to Samaria, and for 3 years he besieged it. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria. And he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. And this occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods, and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel, and in the customs that the kings of Israel had practiced. And the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they made offerings on all the high places, as the nations did whom the Lord carried away before them. And they did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger. And they served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this." Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your fathers and that I sent to you by my servants, the prophets." But they would not listen, but were stubborn, as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They despised his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and the warnings that he gave them. They went after false idols and became false, and they followed the nations that were around them, concerning whom the Lord had commanded them that they should not do like them. And they abandoned all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves metal images of two calves. And they made an Asherah, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. And they burned their sons and their daughters as offerings, and used divination and omens, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel, and removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah only. Judah also did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs that Israel had introduced. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, and afflicted them, and gave them into the hand of plunderers, until he cast them off out of his sight. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, and made them commit great sin. The people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. And the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. And at the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you have carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them, because they do not know the law of the God of the land." Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from here, and let him go and dwell there and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own, and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anemelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They also feared the Lord, and appointed from among themselves all sorts of people as priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. So they feared the Lord, but also served their own gods, after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. To this day they do according to the former manner. They do not fear the Lord, and they do not follow the statutes, or the rules, or the law, or the commandment that the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. The Lord made a covenant with them and commanded them, "You shall not fear other gods, or bow yourselves to them, or serve them, or sacrifice to them. But you shall fear the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm. You shall bow yourselves to him, and to him you shall sacrifice. And the statutes and the rules and the law and the commandment that he wrote for you, you shall always be careful to do. You shall not fear other gods, and you shall not forget the covenant that I have made with you. You shall not fear other gods, but you shall fear the Lord your God, and he will deliver you out of the hand of all your enemies." However, they would not listen, but they did according to their former manner. So these nations feared the Lord, and also served their carved images. Their children did likewise, and their children's children, as their fathers did, so they do to this day. We'll finish our reading there at the end of 2 Kings 17, verse 41. Well, here we have the conclusive end of the northern kingdom of Israel, those 10 tribes. We start in chapter 17 with the account of the last king of the northern kingdom, Hoshea, and how he was a better king than those who went before him, but still evil, not as evil. But the king of Assyria, Shalmaneser, comes against him. Initially, of course, he was a vassal to Shalmaneser, the fifth king with that name, who reigned from 726 to 722 BC. But then he decides that he could side with Egypt and that he might be able to be free from the control of the Assyrians. But the king of Assyria binds him and brings him, sends him to prison, and then invades the land and besieges it for 3 years. And this brings us to the end of the reign of Shalmaneser, and it's his successor as king who finally destroys the city of Samaria and takes the people into exile. His name is Sargon II. Now, what happens to these 10 tribes? Well, it's become customary to talk about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. You might have heard that phrase. And certainly the people who were living in the land at the time of its defeat were taken into exile. This is a policy that the Assyrians used. As far as historians know, it seems to be the first time in history that a policy like that was used, although it's certainly been used since in more recent times. In 20th century Soviet Union, Stalin was known to move people groups around en masse within his vast territories. And that was a way of breaking their ethnic identity, their connection with their history, and their power. And the Assyrians did that to lessen the likelihood of revolt, to mix up the peoples, and quite possibly as well, at least in part, to remove them from their connection with their gods, because the idea was that gods were connected with territory, and if you moved the people, then they could no longer depend on the power of their god. And so many of those people were lost to history. They would have assimilated in amongst the people that they were settled among. We're told some of the places that they were taken to, but they lost their identity. There was certainly no return from exile for these people from the Northern Kingdom. But that doesn't mean that their tribes were entirely lost. In fact, when we get to the return from exile, we have mention of people who come from tribes other than the tribe of Judah. Now, remember, of course, the southern kingdom, although it's said here only Judah was left, Judah had already absorbed Simeon, which was a small tribe that lived within the territory of Judah, surrounded by Judah, and also the other small tribe of Benjamin. But the tribes in the northern kingdom, there were Levites already, and priests, of course, in the southern kingdom who were from the tribe of Levi. But people from the northern kingdom had moved down to the southern kingdom. They would have gone there. Those who were determined to remain faithful to the temple worship would have travelled down. Some of them stayed there. At the time of the conquest of the northern kingdom, some may have moved down to the south. So it's not as if those tribes were lost in their entirety. Now, the prophets looked forward to a day when Israel, in its entirety, both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, would be restored. And what happens at the end of the exile is that a small remnant from the southern kingdom, predominantly from the tribe of Judah, now known as Jews, a contraction of that name, came back to the land and resettled and rebuilt Jerusalem. But as I said, amongst them were some from the northern kingdom, so perhaps that was the seed of the restoration of the whole of Israel. Or perhaps God is going to bring those people back in another way. If they're merged into the peoples who live in modern-day Iran and Central Asia, the areas that they and Iraq that they were distributed to, then perhaps the fact that some of those people have come to faith in God may be descendants of these northern tribes. God will be faithful to his promise. But what we're left with no doubt about in this chapter is the reason for the exile. It is because of their idolatry. It's because they set up those golden calves in the northern kingdom. It's because they did wicked things. They served idols. They rejected the warnings that God sent them through the prophets. They were stubborn. They despised God and his covenant. They followed the nations that were around them. And they abandoned God's commandments and made idols instead. So the abandonment, rejection of God and his word, and the worship instead of idols and Baal. For these reasons, God allowed them to be taken into exile. Judah also did the same, didn't keep the commandments of God, verse 19 says, and they followed the influence of Israel. So that seems that God also holds against the northern kingdom their negative influence on the southern kingdom. And for this reason, the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, verse 23 says, as he had said he would through the prophets. But the other thing that the Assyrians do is to resettle Samaria. They move people from other places to come and live in Samaria. The list of peoples in verse 24 and the gods that they introduce, which are mentioned later on in verse 29 onwards, these probably didn't happen in one move. It would have been waves of immigration over a period of time. But the remarkable thing is that God continues to move and to work. These people bring with them their false gods, but God sends lions among them. In the same way that we've seen God using wild animals earlier in 1st and 2nd Kings, he does it now. And so the king of Assyria, this report comes to him. They don't know the God of the land. Again, notice the Assyrians linking the land with, or the God with the land. And so the king sends a priest to live in Bethel and to teach them how to worship Yahweh. These people are introduced to God, and some of them undoubtedly became true worshippers of God. These are people from the nations. Despite Israel's sin, God is still working out his purpose of bringing knowledge of him and his glory to the nations through the Israelites, even when they have been unfaithful with him, to him. It's a beautiful little indicator of the Lord's grace. Now, of course, many of those people, though, worship their own gods and the Lord, and we're told they did that even to the time of the writing of this book. But another interesting marker is you notice that they're called at least once in this passage Samaritans, after the name of the city where they were settled, verse 29. And of course, you've heard of the Samaritans in the time of Jesus. They're the descendants of these people who were settled in this land, but who were taught about Yahweh. And by the time of Jesus, the Samaritans were worshipping Yahweh, were worshipping the Lord. They had turned away from their false gods. They were worshipping him. They weren't worshipping him according to knowledge. They didn't worship in the Jerusalem temple. They built their own temple on a mountain in their own territory. But they were worshipping God, and they were ready for the coming of the Messiah. They were hoping that the Messiah would come. And so when Jesus meets the Samaritan woman by the well in John chapter 4, he's able to have a conversation with her and to explain that the time has now come when people will worship God in spirit and in truth. And she realizes who he is, or at least has a strong sense that he is probably the Messiah. And so she goes and tells her village people that there's a man that they must come and hear. And many Samaritans come and hear Jesus. God working out his purpose, even through the acts of an evil empire like the Assyrians, bringing judgment on the 10 tribes, but also bringing grace to the nations and preparing the way for a harvest that would be reaped by Jesus himself when he came to Samaria. So it's a tragic event. It's a stark warning to us of the seriousness of idolatry. I suppose the challenge for you and me is this: what idols do we have in our lives? What false gods do we serve and worship alongside the true God? It's unlikely to be statues. It's unlikely to be the gods who are named here. It's more likely to be fame or popularity or wealth, money, or the favor of other people. But these things are dangerous. God will not have a rival. God is a jealous God. He wants our undivided affection. He has made a covenant with us through the Lord Jesus, just as he did with Israel. And he says to us, you shall not fear other gods or bow yourself to them or serve them or sacrifice to them, but you shall fear the Lord who has redeemed you with great power and an outstretched arm. Bow to him, sacrifice to him. Don't forget his covenant. Don't fear other gods, but fear the Lord your God, and he will deliver you. Let us not be like the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, who would not listen. Let us serve him. Let us follow him. Let's tear down the idols of our hearts, and let's devote ourselves to God alone.